This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. The same time you hear us on the air, we are streaming at prairiepublic.org, and you can always find the show after the broadcast at the same place. And today on our show, the COVID-19 pandemic has left many people working or learning from home. For some, the transition is pretty easy, but that can depend on what you know about technology. Today, we'll share a discussion from the Prairie Pulse television show about digital literacy and Microsoft TechSpark, which pairs tech professionals with teachers and others. North Dakota's Microsoft campus is home to one of the 9 regional centers in the U.S. and Mexico. Taya Spellhaug is a TechSpark manager and John Harris's guest on Prairie Pulse.
Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
As we get started, tell the folks a little bit about yourself and your background.
Of course. So I am a North Dakota farm girl, grew up just south of here in Kindred, North Dakota, spent time in 4-H and FFA all the way through high school, and then went to NDSU. After college, spent time in higher ed, for the most part at NDSCS, North Dakota State College of Science, down in Wahpeton, and then also here in Fargo. Spent a couple years at the United Way of Cass and Clay County, which was amazing. About 2.5 years ago is when I came over and took over as the manager of Microsoft's TechSpark program.
What is the Microsoft TechSpark initiative?
Sure. So really, in its essence, it's a philanthropic program within our Microsoft Philanthropies that really looks at economic development for rural parts of America. And so it started about 3 years ago. Our president, Brad Smith, saw a need with more intense help in rural parts of America, saw that there needs to be more rural broadband initiatives. There needs to be more computer science education with kids and workforce development. And they were all already kind of doing these things. And so what they did is they just packaged it together, called it TechSpark, and then rolled it out into 6 different locations right away. We've expanded a little bit, and then chose North Dakota as one of the locations.
How did it get started? Was it funding through something, or did Microsoft pick it?
So Brad Smith, he oversees Microsoft Philanthropies. Okay. And so it is funded within our Microsoft Philanthropies programming at Microsoft. Really, when he looked at it, he said, we've got 5 initiatives, computer science education, workforce development, try to get people educated around computer science. In order to fill those skills gaps, there's a lot of need for people to have those skills in any and every business. And so we're helping to do that. We also look at, like I said, the broadband, the rural broadband. North Dakota's got a lot of real good rural broadband, but there's still a need. And so how are we going to help support those people, especially farmers, here with rural broadband? Then we look at digital transformation. So that's a big one on how are we helping move the needle for businesses in rural North Dakota on transforming their businesses with our digital technologies. So we've had some really great and fun success with NDSU and some startups. And then finally, just since we're in philanthropies, we look at nonprofits that are in our region. And so we've been able to help support quite a few nonprofits on the great work that they're doing here.
Is this happening in other areas where Microsoft's involved? Or so why Fargo and North Dakota?
Right. Each region's very unique. And North Dakota is the only one with the actual Microsoft locations. 3 others in Southern Virginia, Wyoming, and then Eastern Washington have data centers. But we're the only one with an actual Microsoft site. But that wasn't the only reason why we were chosen. Really, the climate and what we're doing here in North Dakota, the fact that we're incredibly rural, but we're also really progressive on what we're trying to do with computer science and technology, thanks to our governor, Doug Burgum, and our CIO. And so it was just a really good opportunity to land that here in North Dakota.
You've been involved in agriculture.
Yeah.
And so what is the Grand Farm?
Sure. So the Grand Farm, it's an initiative actually through Emerging Prairie. We got involved with it. Each region, each TechSpark region, is slated to have a signature project. And so it's really looking at who are the great partners in our region and who are, what are some of our industries in our region that we can really help support. And so it was a really natural fit to look at Emerging Prairie being a fantastic partner and then agriculture. It's a physical location. It's actually 6 miles south of the Microsoft campus. So the physical location is really looking at autonomous farming or digitizing ag. How do we help support the legacies of farmers and not try to take away their jobs, but really help support their production, their ag production, how to help, like I said, support their legacy down the road. But besides the physical location, there's other aspects of the grand farm that they look at, you know, an accelerator for startups. That's one piece. Another piece is merging Digital Academy, which is helping to create programmers in our region, which is definitely a need. We need to train more people on how to become a programmer. So this academy is doing that. And then they look at policy. Just like what we're doing up in Grand Sky and Grand Forks, we're able to look at some policy changes that could happen around digitizing ag. When we looked at those pieces and then we looked at the five pieces of TechSpark, they really worked well together. It was just a natural fit to go in and say, all right, let's support this. You know, let's have a great time with this. Let's also, you know, with Microsoft's name supporting this, how are we getting other partners involved? And that's been really fun to see. We just launched this in October, and we've already had quite a few other partners coming on board, and it's been incredible to see that intensity and that hunger for digitizing ag.
So how and why is it so important to connect with rural North Dakota? You hit on it some, but...
Yeah, it's a place that hasn't been touched as much. It's a place that we need to continue what we're doing with rural America in order to help everybody succeed and move forward. And so we don't want to see rural America go away. We don't want to see the businesses go the way of Kodak. Those are the reasons why we're helping support. And if we can get everybody on the internet, you know, everybody broadband access, it's going to help everybody in the United States.
Yeah. How many regions does Microsoft have in this initiative, and, you know, what and where are they?
Sure. So we originally started with six. In the last 2.5 years, we've morphed a little bit. We've taken on some bigger locations. I had mentioned Virginia, Wyoming, Eastern Washington, but we also started with Wisconsin as well. And then El Paso, Texas, which is a little bit bigger. And then the next year, we actually went into Juarez, Mexico, so right across the border. Mm-hmm. They have some interesting issues that are also similar to the issues that are facing rural America. And so it was a really good fit for them as well. But they also have large military and veterans there. So that was a great opportunity to do some great work there. And then recently we added Miami and also Detroit. All in all, we have 9 different locations across the United States looking at rural but then underserved communities that are underserved by technology companies.
Do you travel to these regions, or does somebody, another manager at all the other regions?
Yeah, great question, because really what we wanted to do at Microsoft is make sure that we have local people on the ground. And so I just manage North Dakota. I'm from here. I've worked, like I said, in education, nonprofits. So they wanted somebody who understood the region, had connections within the region, and then they chose a manager for each of those 9 locations.
How are y'all closing the gap, or how do we close the gap in computer science education in rural North Dakota?
Yeah. The great thing about that is we're trying to do that already in North Dakota. Kirsten Basler, our superintendent of public instruction, the rest of DPI, we're really focusing in on computer science education. We helped support CTE and DPI last year with the legislative session around computer science, and we launched the first ever computer and cybersecurity standards K-12 in the nation, which is really cool. And so we helped a little bit with that, but we also really wanted to create some buzz around computer science. I think oftentimes people don't understand the need for it. So we've done some really interesting things. We have an event called Hour of Code. Coding is that programming that you do. And so we do it with kids. And when I took on this position, they said, all right, you need to go out and do an Hour of Code event. And I was looking on the website, and I saw that Kindred, my hometown, had done it. So I called up some of the people that I knew there, and I said, hey, would you guys want to do an event? And the elementary school principal got really involved with it, and she goes, you know, let's do the whole entire elementary. And it was fabulous. We had 450 kids on the gym floor coding at the same time. It was mass chaos, but we called it organized chaos. My 4 nieces and nephews were there. It was fabulous. And we had second graders helping 6th graders. It was just a really fabulous time. And Doug Burgum, our governor, showed up, was treated like a rock star. They were all excited. And so I think that momentum just really sparked the fact that this is needed. And so a few people had asked, well, we did a whole school. Can you do the whole state next year? And we kind of laughed about it, and then we decided to do it. So actually last year we did a statewide, first ever in the nation, statewide Hour of Code for North Dakota, partnering again with DPI, CTE, Edutech, which is through ITD in North Dakota. We were in 100 school districts across North Dakota, and we had over 6,000 kids coding at the same time, same day. People were talking about that. That kind of got the buzz on that part. But we have another program through Microsoft called TEALS that also helps to drive that computer science education a little bit forward.
Yeah. Is there an issue with finding people to teach things like this in rural North Dakota?
Yeah, there is, for sure. I believe the stat was that there was only 5 actual computer science teachers in the state of North Dakota, and 2 of them were in administration. You need to have that expertise. And so what we've been doing is we've been working with EduTech on training teachers on how to become computer science teachers, but also be able to incorporate it into classrooms. We have an amazing teacher out in Richland, Mrs. Carlson, that she incorporates it into her history class, you know, computer science. And it's really cool to see these different types of programs happening across the state. But another program that we have is like I said, called TEALS.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Sure. Yeah, so it's Teacher Education and Literacy in Schools. So it's an acronym. We love acronyms at Microsoft. Pairing an actual computer science professional, so engineer, with an in-house teacher. So the in-house teacher raises their hand and says, I would like to be that teacher to help teach computer science. And then we either remote in or actually have a person come in physically to that class to teach the curriculum that we have built for computer science education. And it's a really great opportunity for the kids to interact with somebody in the industry and then also have that teacher learn how to teach computer science along the way. Usually after 3 years, that in-house teacher knows the information well enough to continue to teach it. So it's a sustainable model. So we don't always have to have those professional people, those volunteers, because they're 100% volunteer, to be in there every single time. They're able to come with kind of phase out of those schools and then teach in other schools. So it's an amazing program. We're in all over the United States, many all over the United States, but we have 15 different schools around North Dakota that have TEALS within them. So it's been pretty cool.
So it sounds like that program's been going pretty good so far, but
yeah.
Are there things you can do to improve it?
Always, always. You know, I think what's great about it is the more we talk about it, I think there's a lot of people that say, hey, how do we get involved? How do we help what you're doing? And so those partnerships really start blossoming. And as we're moving forward, Microsoft kind of pivots a little bit and takes another look at, we're doing great things here. Now maybe we can focus a little bit more. Workforce development is a big one. And so we've done a lot with computer science education. We're still focusing on that. Now we're looking at how are we helping to support the workforce. With AI and automation, there's a lot of things that are changing in the workforce. We talk about every business being a technology business, and that there are people that need to understand computer science. And so how are we helping somebody that may have lost their job due to automation, but now can get a better job once they get some skills and learning how to do that? And so we have an initiative to try to get as many people as we can to really get upskilled and reskilled with those skills in computer science.
Yeah. Well, I may be wrong here, but it seems like your background's not really in technology, but you seem well-versed in it. And so how do you go about going out and explaining this to businesses and individuals?
Right. Fake it till you make it. No, it's more a lot of learning. I do. My background is actually in mental health counseling. So this was something new to me, but I've learned a lot. We had a lot of amazing people back in Microsoft, in Redmond, who've done some really great education. And then it's a lot of going out and meeting with people and understanding the needs and then bringing back those needs to Redmond and having the really incredibly smart people who understand technology help with that. So it's a really good just kind of marriage of different personalities and partnerships.
You've mentioned Governor Burgum 2 or 3 times here mm-hmm. in our conversation, but you know, how much has he been involved and is the state involved at all?
Yeah, so we are really, it's a blessing to have Doug Burgum as our governor and take an initiative on computer science education. He's definitely been a supporter of what we're doing with his connection with Microsoft. It's always good, but he's also looking at it. I mean, this is a rural economic development program. He's all about the Main Street Initiative and helping support economic development in rural America. So it aligns really well with his initiatives as well. It's been great to, you know, when we were pitching, because we had to pitch the $1.5 million Grand Farm initiative, and he spent time with us to look over and said, you know, he's used to working with Microsoft, and so he took some time with us to look over our pitch and give us some critiquing, and it was great. So it was really fun to have a governor that's so involved in what we're doing here in our state.
Yeah. How many people are employed on the Fargo campus of Microsoft?
Yeah. It's a great question to get that often, because when I say I'm from North Dakota and we have a site, people don't often think that we have a big site, but it is. We have probably around 1,600 people that work either for or with Microsoft at the campus in South Fargo. And so we have about, I would say, 1,100 full-time employees and about 500 contractors that work for Microsoft. In the past, we were the second largest Microsoft campus, but we're right around 4 or 5, ebbs and flows.
Well, let's go back to your initiative real quick. You know, how is it funded, and where do you see it going in the future?
It started off as a 5-year initiative. So how are we going to drive as much change and impact into rural America in these 5 years? And kind of at the halfway point, the 2.5 years, it doesn't mean that we're not going to continue to move on. It could definitely evolve as the world is changing, and Microsoft's very good at you know, pivoting and meeting the needs of different areas and different customers. Right now, we're going to be focusing a lot on the Grand Farm and that signature project. We're going to be working a lot with trying to find other partners, getting the word out, and seeing who else we can bring to North Dakota. We've had conversations with people from Morocco and companies from Morocco. And so that's really fun to see that they're saying, hey, you've got this Microsoft in town. This is actually something that's going to happen. So it's been pretty cool.
We're out of time. So if people want more information, where can they go? Who can they contact?
Yeah, so they can definitely look me up on LinkedIn, Taya Spellhaug, or they can go to Microsoft.com/TechSpark.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
That was Taya Spellhaug, a Microsoft TechSpark manager with Prairie Pulse host John Harris. You can see the entire program on our television service Friday evening at 7:30 Central. Poetry from Studio 47 is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them, in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
This week on Away with Words, sometimes language takes the long way around.
I had a meal with some friends here in Williamsburg, where I live about half a year, and afterwards observed to them that it was good crack. And they all looked askance at me, thinking I was talking about cocaine.
Join us.
I'm going to tell you how the cow ate the cabbage, and you're not going to like what my answer is.
That's Away with Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming, along with our members and other sources, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. For people of a certain age, certain poems are familiar. Patrick Hicks is a writer in residence at Augustana University in Sioux Falls and the host of the Poetry from Studio 47 podcast. Today, he profiles Carl Sandburg.
Sandburg was born in Galesburg, Illinois, on January 6, 1878. He grew up in poverty, and at the age of 13, he left school to look for work. He did a variety of odd jobs, including washing dishes, laying bricks, and working as a farmhand. When he turned 17, he volunteered for the United States Army, and he was sent to Puerto Rico with the 6th Illinois Infantry Division, where he fought in the Spanish-American War. After his service, he returned to Galesburg, where he enrolled in Lombard College. Even though his writing attracted the attention of his professors, Sandburg left in 1903 without receiving a degree. This hardly slowed him down, though. He moved to Milwaukee, where he began to work in the newspaper business, and while there, he married Lillian Striken. Together, they moved to Chicago, a city that would have an enormous impact on his imagination. Sandburg became the editor of the Chicago Daily News and began writing poetry. He wrote in free verse, much like his hero, Walt Whitman. It was during this time that Sandburg began working on a project that would ultimately consume him for decades. He had long admired Abraham Lincoln, and he started to collect material that would become a multi-volume biography of the man. Sandburg also began to collect traditional American music. In fact, it was common to hear him read poetry and then sing folk songs with his guitar. His many, many books include Chicago Poems, Cornhuskers, Smoke and Steel, Slabs of the Sunburnt West, Good Morning America, Harvest Poems, Honey and Salt, and his biographical volumes on the life of Abraham Lincoln. Among the many accolades and awards that Sandburg won over his lifetime are 3 Pulitzer Prizes and a Robert Frost Medal. In 1945, he and his wife moved to a large rural estate called Connemara in Flat Rock, North Carolina, and he would continue to live and work there until his death on July 22, 1967. According to his wishes, his ashes were laid to rest in the backyard of the house where he was born in Galesburg, Illinois. When he passed away, President Lyndon Johnson said, "Carl Sandburg was more than the voice of America. He was America." Today's poem is Chicago. I first became aware of Carl Sandburg when I was very young, maybe 8 or 9 years old. My father, you see, was born and raised in Galesburg, and whenever we went to visit my grandparents, who lived fairly close to Sandburg's childhood home, we sometimes stopped by to walk around the place. I have very clear memories of being in his house, of standing in the room where he slept, of looking into a mirror at my reflection and realizing that he once did this too. I was too young at the time to know his work, but it left an impression on me. Poets were not mythical creatures for me. They were real people, and they came from places like Galesburg, Illinois. Becoming a writer, I reasoned as a child, actually seemed possible. Since then, I've returned to Sandburg's home a few times as an adult, and whenever I do, I go back to that mirror and see his reflection, along with my own, as a kid. What a gift this was for me, and what a gift his work was for America in the early part of the 20th century. He was a poet who celebrated life in the Midwest. He was unapologetic for loving this part of America, and he wrote with awe about the mighty cities and industries that rose up from the prairie. Today's poem, Chicago, is the celebration of that big, loud, truly American city. Of all the poems that capture Midwest America, this might be my favorite. This is Chicago by Carl Sandburg. Hog butcher for the world, toolmaker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads and the nation's freight handler, stormy, husky, brawling, city of the big shoulders. They tell me you are wicked, and I believe them, for I have seen your painted women under the gas lamps luring the farm boys. And they tell me you are crooked, and I answer, yes, it is true. I have seen the gunmen kill and go free to kill again. And they tell me you are brutal, and my reply is, on the faces of women and children, I have seen the marks of wanton hunger. And I have answered so, I turn once more to those who sneer at this my city, and I give them back the sneer, and say to them, come and show me another city, with lifted head, singing so proud to be alive and coarse and strong and cunning, flinging magnetic curses amid the toil of piling job on job. Here is a tall, bold slugger set vivid against the little soft cities, fierce as a dog with tongue lapping for action, cunning as a savage pitted against the wilderness, bareheaded, shoveling, wrecking, planning, building, breaking, rebuilding, under the smoke, dust all over his mouth, laughing with white teeth under the terrible burden of destiny, laughing as a young man laughs, laughing even as an ignorant fighter laughs who has never lost a battle, bragging and laughing that under his wrist is the pulse, and under his ribs the heart of the people, laughing. Laughing the stormy, husky, brawling laughter of youth, half-naked, sweating, proud to be hog-butcher, toolmaker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads, and the freight handler to the nation.
The Poetry from Studio 47 podcast is curated and hosted by Patrick Hicks and produced at Augustana University by Peter Folliard. Coming up on the show, Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom featuring sourdough bread. And we'll hear how a North Dakota live production company is adapted to stream entertainment and keep musicians working. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Red River in Fargo-Moorhead is expected to reach its peak at a much lower level than earlier predicted. An updated flood outlook from the National Weather Service calls for a likely crest of between 31 and 33 feet late next week, just beyond 30 feet, which is considered major flooding. The lack of snow or rain in the last several weeks and a near-perfect snowmelt has lessened the threat of serious flooding. Fargo, with the help of volunteers, filled more than 220,000 sandbags earlier this month. A Fargo gun dealer says that after 13 years in the business, he's never seen anything like it.
Gun sales have been skyrocketing. Ammunition sales have been skyrocketing. Through the manufacturers and distributors and wholesalers, it's even hard to get a lot of the guns to sell now.
Jeff Mack owns Mack Tactical Custom Firearms in South Fargo. Mack says customers are buying guns because they're concerned that the COVID-19 pandemic will lead to fewer jobs, a damaged economy, and a rise in crime.
Gun sales have been skyrocketing.
Mack says over the past 2 weeks, sales at his store alone have jumped to up to 60% across the country. The FBI processed more than 5.5 million background checks in January and February. And the executive director of the North Dakota Racing Commission says the two horse race meets scheduled this summer could be affected by the COVID-19 virus. The racing season is supposed to start June 6th at Chippewa Downs in Belcourt and in July at the North Dakota Horse Park in Fargo. Jack Schultz told the commission those dates could be affected by the virus. Schultz says the commission will meet at the end of April to look at options.
One would be to run as scheduled if things have cleared up enough to allow that. A second option, which is being done at some of the racetracks around the country, is to run without spectators. Third option would be to back the races up to July, August, or August, September, if that's feasible at the time. Obviously, another one would be to cancel the races altogether.
Commission Chairman Dave Pepcorn says he understands the situation, but...
I'd not encourage us having races without people there. And I think in 30 days, we're going to have a lot clearer vision of what can happen. But, well, I think if we pushed our races in Fargo into the fall, we'd have even better attendance than during the summer. And so we have lots of options and we have some time.
Schultz says his absolute last option would be to cancel this year's race meets. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And joining me from our Bismarck studio is Sue Balcom from the Root Cellars Farm outside of Mandan. It's time for Main Street Eats. Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And you want to talk about...
Bread.
Yes.
Oh my
foundational
gosh.
Food here across right. cultures, across meals.
The staff of life.
Right.
It's biblical in nature, and it's been around that long, too, you know. Bread, flat bread, bread without yeast. And then there came the advent of sourdough, which was kind of like the beginning of bread that was not flat but raised.
Okay. So what is a sourdough?
That is a process more than it is a recipe for making bread from naturally fermented flour and water. It's fairly easy to do, but you have to be very diligent about keeping that starter fed, unlike yeast, which is shelf-stable and a totally different beast than sourdough.
So the process would be...
So you can create your own sourdough starter quite easily by taking a cup of flour and a cup of water, mixing it together and leaving it on your countertop till it starts to bubble and brew. Mm. And then you know that you have some active cultures in
there. In a bowl, in a bag?
I usually use a wide-mouth mason jar.
Okay.
And so that won't fill the jar full because you have to be careful. Like I have such an active starter after 5 years or 6 years of doing this that one time blew the top off of my container and I still can see pieces
that's so
of
hard to clean.
Dough. I know. You have to get like a jackknife or something to scrape it off your woodwork. So I'm hoping that nobody else looks up under that lighting area.
That's
in
the first
kitchen,
place I'm going
so,
when I go to your house. Yeah. You said
oh
one cup
gosh.
Of flour. Does it matter if it's all purpose or bread flour or wheat flour?
I very seldom use bread flour. I just use a basic flour. I do use unbromated and unbleached flour. And I start it with white flour because these cultures, once you get them activated and start feeding them whole grains, they love whole grains. They eat that at twice the speed, I think, of white flour. Mm. So you can just use what you've got in your kitchen. Now, if you have mashed potatoes for Sunday dinner, you can save a cup of that potato water. And you can use that. Those additional starches will also help that culture get going. Hmm. And then some people use like sliced apple on the top. I mean, there's all kinds of different ways to do starters. And I do know that the research that I did down in German-Russian country where I come from, they actually started their starter with a little bit of yeast. However, that does not – that can't be called a sourdough bread if you have yeast in, because yeast is something else. Yeast is like a mold or a fungus that they actually collect. They grow it and they collect it and they dry it and then they put it in – packages.
You grow yeast? It's like a plant?
Or yes, it's
something
like a
that
fungus.
Shows up on plants?
Yes, it's like a fungus. And I can't remember the word because it's like a really, 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 really long word. Let me see if I have it here. I don't know. Anyway, it, so that is not, and I have heard that you should not, if you're subject to yeast infections, you should definitely not be eating bread with yeast in, because that is something that does grow. Whereas sourdough bread is actually good for people who can that are gluten intolerant, you know, not celiac. That's a disease. That's a real legitimate stay away from bread products. But if you find that store-bought bread makes you feel bloated or whatever, sourdough bread, you've got to try. And it's not, like I said, a recipe. So you create a culture, and you've got this culture growing, and it's living, and you have to feed it. And so you've got a cup of flour and a cup of water, and it grows. And so you want to feed it after it bubbles up, and then it falls down again. You want to give it another cup of water and another cup of flour. And then you want to split it in half. And you can either throw half of it away or bake with that. And then you can store your other half in the refrigerator for a week or two. Then bring it out, bring it to room temperature, feed it again, split it in half, do your baking, and put the other one in the refrigerator. I've actually also dried some of my sourdough starter. In the event of a zombie apocalypse, I have like a full container of sourdough starter chips in my basement so that I can rejuvenate those at any time that I need to bake bread. So, and I could share with my neighbors that way.
Which you will need to do in an apocalypse.
Yes, definitely have to have bread. And I hope by then I have a brick oven outside, because that makes the best ever bread. So let's run quickly through the process then, is that you take a cup of starter and you add it to 3 cups of flour, and then you put a, you know, you kind of mix it together. It gets a little shaggy looking, and then you put in a cup of water and you mix that up, and you end up with a very, very loose or sticky dough. However, the more you let that rise, like you can let your dough rise 4 hours, unlike yeast doughs, which usually rise in about an hour. You punch them down, they rise again, you know, you let them rise and bake them. This is something you could start in the morning and allow it to rise while you're at work. You do not add your salt until after it autolyses, which is 20 to 30 minutes of just flour absorbing the water and the starter. And so then instead of kneading your dough, you actually stretch and fold your salt in. Then you can let that rest for another 30 minutes. You can stretch and fold, let it rest another 30 minutes, stretch and fold, form your dough, your loaves, your little rounds, your baguettes, whatever you're doing. Put them on linen cloths or in linen baskets to raise. Linen is a very, very sourdough-friendly fabric, and when you do baguettes, you use a linen cloth to kind of help them hold their shape while they're raising. There's all kinds of little things you can add into that if you wish, but then it's baked at a really, really high temperature oven that you have to introduce some water to by way of ice cubes in the bottom of your oven. Whoa. Or squirting water into the oven, because all of those really good crusty breads are baked in.
They're the high hydration breads.
Yep, injected ovens. They have water that is injected into the oven chamber. And so it's a little bit not quite as solid of a bake as you would if you had like a really nice expensive oven, but it can be done.
I tried that high hydration once and I broke my baking stone.
Ooh, no, bummer. So secret is not to squirt the water on the stone, right?
Just the bread.
Just the bread, and or, you know, put a tray underneath there that you can dump ice cubes in and then quickly shut the oven door, and that will create enough steam in there. Or you can bake that in a casserole or a cast iron dish that has a cover on it. That helps keep it moist while it's baking also.
Now, you mentioned several different types of bread that you would make with this, but would you, Sue Balcom, ever make, like, is there, I don't know, a sourdough pancake or something that's still in the bread family that isn't bread?
Right, and that's where that sourdough cast off comes in. You know, like I know it's only flour and it's like maybe 20 or 30 cents a cup. But you know, you've got this baby, right? You've been growing this baby. So rather than dump that down your septic, which is good for the septic because yeast is good to eat, you know, microbes and, you know, they're down there doing their thing in your septic system also. And so it's okay to dump that out as long as you dilute it enough so it doesn't like harden in your pipes. Because like you said, you could build a house out of sourdough starter, I swear. So you can use that for making pancakes. You can make biscuits. There's all kinds of other recipes, cookies, all kinds of things that you can use this in. Starter for.
What would you do with it if you're going to be gone a couple weeks? Do you just refrigerate it or do you just start over when you get back?
Nope. I never start over. I've had sourdough starter in my fridge for months and I can get it to come back to life. Okay. You have to be a little patient and you have to probably feed it 3 or 4 days. Yeah, it's a total thought process here. You have to plan way ahead if you're going to bake sourdough bread so that you can make sure that yeast is alive again.
How do you know if your starter's gone bad?
If you see mold on it.
Okay.
Sometimes you will see a black liquid on the top that is when it begins to create alcohol. You know, it's fermented up to a certain point. If it continues to ferment like it's supposed to, then it starts creating alcohol. And there are people that actually just dump that black water off or they mix it back into their starter because that will add a little bit of a tang that you wouldn't normally have.
So that's okay,
but actual mold, okay. If it starts turning purplish or greenish, and if it smells really, really bad, then you want to throw it away and start over.
All right. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, Ashley. It's been a pleasure.
Uh-oh, the kids are stuck home? Well, there is some help. Prairie Public reminds you about PBS Kids. It's on the television, but there's also pbskids.org, where you can find all kinds of educational and fun games and activities. pbskids.org or PBS Kids on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Kent Kolstad. He is the president and technical director of Livewire Productions, and he joins us by phone from his office in Fargo. Thank you for joining us, Kent.
Thanks so much for having me, Doug.
Kent, the reason I'm getting a hold of you is because I got a message from you via email earlier today, as many other people did, that Livewire is live streaming concerts featuring regional artists, and by virtue of doing that, helping to support them. Let's get a little background. First of all, what is Livewire?
Livewire is a local live event production company. We provide audio, video, lighting, staging, and scenery for corporate events, concerts, theatrical events of any size, and we do so both around the region and throughout the country.
So the pandemic has probably affected your business.
It really has. We've seen the next 3 to 4 months of work just completely obliterated as far as live event production is concerned. We were grateful to be able to engage our team with this project, Live at Livewire.
So talk about Live at Livewire. This is a concert series. How did this get started?
So it kind of was an idea just generated by our team as something that we could do in the meantime. We realized quickly that if our live event calendar was basically being emptied out in, you know, a 24-hour period, that a lot of our friends who are local musicians and in bands and performing arts would likely be faced with similar situations. And so we saw an opportunity to quickly help them out by means of doing these live streamed concerts from our facility near downtown Fargo. And so we're, of course, being very careful with this, too. From a health perspective, we're making sure that we don't have any more than 10 people in our facility at any given time. We're making sure that everybody's healthy on arrival. We're making sure that we're abiding by all the rules and regulations that are out there. But it's a really fun way for us to both, you know, engage creatively from a production standpoint and keep our team engaged, as I mentioned earlier, but also raise funds for these musicians. So for each episode, we're setting up a GoFundMe. And so folks can visit that website just by going to live@livewire.com to donate for that night's specific musicians that are playing. And 100% of the proceeds are going to the musicians. And we're excited in that we've actually taken on our first big corporate sponsor to help sustain our work on the Livewire side of this. So it's a win for all sides. It's a good way to sort of bide our time, both creatively and professionally. And we're excited to share these with the community.
Now, this evening, the Crop Dusters are featured and guitarist Sean Mitzel. So tell our listeners how they can access the show.
Everyone can access our show a number of different ways. We'll have a link to the stream on our website at livewirenow.com. We'll have it streaming on our Facebook page. If you just search Livewire on Facebook.com, it'll take you right to us. And we'll have a unique stream for each individual episode. So that will be posted in the hours leading up to each event.
Now, you've done this. How has the response been?
We've had an incredible amount of support, and we've raised just over $1,000 for each episode that has aired thus far, and we've only had two. And again, that money goes directly to the musicians. That's 100% proceeds going to musicians, which is excellent. We're so happy about that. We've had about just over 27,000 unique impressions, streaming impressions, across the episodes that we've raised or that we've aired thus far. So we're very, very excited about that. And excited to see it grow. There seems to be a big need for folks to check out from whatever their current locale is and be able to enjoy some art in the comfort of their home. So we're excited to be able to provide that.
Now, you mentioned you've got a sense of the size of the audience, impressions. How does that relate to people?
Well, we don't know necessarily that, that doesn't necessarily mean that we've had 27,000 people watch by any means across those episodes. But that means watching on unique devices and at different times and perhaps in different locations from episode to episode. So we are seeing a really strong response at any rate based on that number. So we are very, very grateful for that and hope to see it grow, too.
How do you pick the performers?
We actually reached out to a number of our friends in the community who are local musicians and in the entertainment and performing arts industries and just said, hey, is this something that you'd have interest in? We'd love to give it a shot, love to support you. And that has spread like wildfire. So we've had probably about 22 musicians and bands reach out to us and sign up on our roster. We have a number of events coming up here as well, all the way through the 4th of April, I believe, right now. And we are looking to schedule out beyond that as well. This is something that we anticipate might continue past the lockdown of COVID-19. But we're taking it on a day-by-day basis, and we'll see where that lands.
Well, the performers are, I mentioned the Crop Dusters and Sean Mitzel this evening. And what time are these performances?
Every show will start at 5 p.m., and generally speaking, we've been running them until about 9 p.m. Really depends on the musician. I think there's a couple coming up that might be a little bit shorter, but generally the time frame is 5 to 9 p.m. Folks should feel free to tune in at any time throughout, and for that matter, we'll be posting some of the prior episodes as well once we get those produced internally.
Saturday, March 28th, you've got The Human Element and Cold Sweat. Tuesday, the 31st, it's Acoustic Night with Jake Ingemar and James Bergman. Thursday, it's Jessica Vine's album release party with Jessica Vine's, of course, and John Narum, a yo-yo artist. That'll be fun. And then Saturday, Heart and Soul and John Walters. So it's not just music. You've got a yo-yo artist and maybe some other kinds of performers, I take it.
Yeah. We're really opening up to, any arts organization, artist, musician, et cetera, that might have interest. And we're taking it on, again, very much as we are with the entire series at this point. We're taking it on a case-by-case basis and evaluating best options for all sides. We've had a couple of comedians reach out. We've had a couple of folks in the slam poetry realm reach out. So we've got a lot of potential in terms of the type of arts that we're featuring on this show. So we're really, really excited to see how that grows.
As you mentioned, this is something that may continue after the pandemic. Is this a new kind of business model for producers and performers?
Possibly. We've certainly seen success, in other similar similar genres and avenues. So certainly a model might be something like an Austin City Limits or many other live events, live streamed events for that matter. Who knows? It very well could be a great business venture for our team and for local musicians well after this. For our part, we just need, corporate sponsors to jump on and help support us as we produce this. It's been a real pleasure and a joy to do so for these musicians. But, of course, that also does mean that we need to be able to sustain our team as well, both through the pandemic, but also afterwards, should we choose to continue it.
And how big is your team and how are they faring?
We're doing okay. Thank you for asking. We've got about 24 on our roster right now, about 14 of whom are full-time. Everybody's doing all right, very understanding and very gracious across the company. I mean, there's certainly, it's all we can do to try and take care of them and do so to the best of our ability. We're grateful that we haven't had to completely close down our operation as really the entirety of the live event industry has otherwise. So we're hoping that that we can sustain that and see that continue through the pandemic, because we love our team. We're so excited to have them be a part of Livewire, and we're trying to take care of them to the best of our ability through this.
Well, you mentioned that you do have a sponsor at this point, 702 Communications, and you have room for others, I take it?
We do. We have five different sponsorship levels that folks can jump in at. So, I mean, very accessible for a small business or nonprofit organization to jump in. And then for any major sponsors that might be out there, we've got levels that we call promoter and I'm with the band and security, sort of the typical titles that you might see at a concert venue. So we had some fun while we created these sponsorship packages quickly. And certainly we're open to any possibilities out there for individuals or organizations that might want to help support this as we grow it.
Given the technology that people have in their homes these days, how would you gauge the quality of the performance, the production values, if you will, for these musicians?
Very good question. We actually have, we're thankful to have very high-speed internet at our office and warehouse near downtown. Both for the sake of the video production work that we do and for other matters as well. So this has actually provided an ability to provide an HD audio and video stream directly from our downtown location. So as long as the end user, the viewer's internet connection is robust and not being disrupted by anything else that would take major bandwidth, the quality has been very good thus far in terms of the reviews that we've received. So we have been monitoring that and asking the question, but overall, folks have seemingly been very happy with production values thus far.
Kent, one more time, how can people listen this evening?
The simplest way is head to our website, livewirenow.com. That'll take you by link to our Facebook page. Otherwise, if you're on Facebook, just search for Livewire Fargo, take you right there, and we'll have that live stream right at the top of the page.
Kent Kolstad is the founder, president, and technical director of Livewire. Thanks for joining us today, Kent.
Thanks again for having me, Doug. I appreciate it.
Decoded 8-Book is next.
Hey, Prairie musicians. Gigs got scrapped, eh? Are you tired of that live streaming crashing? Well, do something productive with your downtime and maybe even lucrative. Enter the 2020 NPR Tiny Desk Contest. It's a great way to get your music into the ears of a lot of people. The winner will perform at the iconic NPR Tiny Desk in D.C. and go on a national tour. So, practice safe social distancing and film you or your band performing an original song in front of the tiny desk of your choice. And you still have time. The deadline has been extended till April 27th. Just go to npr.org/tinydeskcontest for complete rules and to upload your clip. The 2020 NPR Tiny Desk Contest. Go for it, Prairie musicians.
This is Scott Prebis inviting you to join me on Saturday evenings for Prebis on Jazz, our weekly excursion into the world of big band music, smooth jazz, and great improvisation. Prebis on Jazz, 7 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 26th. Pius Kuntz was born at Napoleon, North Dakota in 1920. He graduated from high school and then spent a year at the State Agriculture College in Fargo. He later traveled to Los Angeles, California to work as a machinist. In 1941, Kuntz married his sweetheart, Miss Virginia Jaycox, and took up residence in Van Nuys, California.
Pius had always been interested in airplanes, so he took flying lessons. And then it was no surprise that when the U.S. entered World War II, Kuntz joined the Army Air Corps. After flight training and receiving his wings, Pius was sent to England to serve with the 9th Air Force's 367th Fighter Group. The 367th was nicknamed the Dynamite Gang. Second Lieutenant Kuntz flew the P-38 twin-engine fighter that he named Napoleon's Delight in honor of his hometown. The 367th became operational in May of 1944 and participated in the D-Day landings, flying cover for the thousands of ships in the English Channel from June 6th to June 8th. The rest of June, the group hit a mix of German targets, including power stations, anti-aircraft defenses, convoys, and troop concentrations inland from the beachheads. As Allied forces rolled through France, the 367th moved to airfields closer to the front. The group spent the rest of the year supporting ground forces and attacking German strong points. In December, the P-38s attacked German units participating in the Battle of the Bulge. In February of 1945, the group's war-weary P-38s were replaced with new single-engine P-47 fighters. Pius flew 45 missions in P-38s and P-47s. He was shot down twice, the last time being fatal. It was on March 25, 1945. Kuntz was on a dive bombing mission against targets near Aschaffenburg, Germany, when his P-47 was hit by flak, struck the ground, and exploded. On this date, he was buried by German civilians near the small town of Dettingen, ironically the same part of Germany that his great-grandparents were from. Kuntz's grave was not found for several years. Finally, in 1949, the grave was located and his body identified. At long last, Pius Gregory Kuntz was brought home to Napoleon and interred at the St. Philip Neri Catholic Cemetery. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Scott Nelson. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
As the coronavirus spreads and disrupts life for Americans, one particular group is facing a secondary threat.
Having people not trust you, having people look at you as a disease carrier, I think that's on a lot of people's minds in the Asian American community.
The coronavirus and racism on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, we'll have a conversation with our film reviewer, Matt Olean, about the impact the pandemic is having on the release of films and the film industry in general. News director Dave Thompson will update us on the COVID-19 developments during the week, and we'll discuss the challenges being faced by homeless shelters with Sue Kesterman, Executive Director of Churches United for the Homeless. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.